Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Writer's Lounge. This is show number 22, May 14th, 2012, and here we are finally making it into the May month, and summer just approaching, and hopefully you'll be picking up a good book and reading it this summer at the beach, wherever you may be in these United States of America or across the world, as we do have people watching, not watching, of course, but listening to us across the world in other countries. So I'm your host, Tom Riedel, and guest hosting today will be Brian Anderson. He wrote the Godling Chronicles, which we had on our program not too long ago. He'll be with us shortly to talk about what's going on in his world. Robin will be back next show, and that will be next week. A brief intro to today's show. We have on today Jonathan Maxwell, and it's a show that will break from the normal. It's a little bit more of a serious subject. It's called Murderous Intellectuals, and it's about Nazi Germany and the evil men who ruled during that time. And we hope and we know he will be with us about quarter after the hour, so stay tuned for that. The Writer's Lounge blog can be found over at tomriedel.com/blog. You can go there and read the reviews that I have written, and also you can listen to the Blog Talk Radio show by listening to the Blog Talk Radio player located in the upper left-hand corner of the page. Of course, everybody has a Facebook link today, and we are no exception. You can find us over at the Blog Talk Radio site. Click on the Facebook link, and it'll take you to our like page. Keep coming with those numbers. We're raising up into the thousands now, and we hope that at some point here within the end of the year, we'll hit the magic 2,000 mark. We're well on our way to doing that. You can also contact us at twl11@yahoo.com. And upcoming guest authors, next week, Bonnie Hartle will be on. She's a former Nashville singer. Yes, that's right. We've had on Academy Award winners, and now we have on a Nashville singer, former Nashville singer, who is writing a book, very serious topic, on her battles with colon cancer. And I think you will find this subject and the subject matter not only serious, but humorous also. And she has been able to move on in her life. And the name of the book, fitting that humor aspect of it, is Where the Sun Don't Shine. So join us next week with Bonnie Hartle. It'll be an amazing program. You're not going to want to miss it. Also, of course, I have to plug the new business that I've just opened up, and it's Magic Pen Web Design. And Magic Pen Web Design offers its clients a simple, effective, and affordable approach to website design development. Magic Pen Web Design promises that your website will be simple in content and easy to navigate, while also delivering an effective eye-popping design that will attract an interest to your product or service. And we also promise to work with you and to explore an option package that will be the most affordable for you. Fill out our free estimate form over at magicpenwebdesign.com and let us help you sell that next book with a website design that will work its magic for you. And now I would like to introduce my guest host for today. And his name is, of course, Brian Anderson, who is a big promoter of the show and also author of the book, The Godling Chronicles. And welcome again, Brian, to the Writer's Lounge.
Hey, Tom, it's good to be here again. How you doing there, buddy?
Doing okay. It's getting warm and summer's approaching, and I'm ready to go to the lakes and do a little fishing and just enjoy my summer here.
It just doesn't seem like the words warm and Minnesota should be in the same sentence, but okay.
Well, believe it or not, we are out here in the summertime. It's a whole different world, so if you're ever going to want to visit Minnesota, make sure you visit in the summertime. Of course, the winter is nice, too, but summers are very special here.
Well, I don't know. Ever since Jesse the Body Ventura is no longer your governor, it just doesn't have the same appeal, man.
Yeah, I like Jesse. I do miss him. So what's new with you, Brian? What's going on in the writing world?
Oh, not much. It's going great. I just finished my second book of the book two of the Godling Chronicles of Gods and Elves. It just went out to the proofreaders not too long ago, who I'd actually like to take an opportunity to thank because they're really doing a great job. I'd like to thank Jen Frith, Mitchell Lee, and Vincentine Williams. They're my proofreaders.
Very good.
Been doing a great job. Yeah, I've been doing a great job helping me, you know, make sure everything is in the right order, make sure the story is flowing right. And it's going to probably go to the editor in, maybe another few weeks, and then I'm hoping to have it out before the end of the year.
And then you got to get that Tom Riddell, guy to do a review of it and get you back on the show.
I've heard good things about it.
Yeah, I've heard good things about him, too. I've also heard not so good things about him, but we'll leave that for another time.
Depends on who you ask, man.
That's right. But we're all about writing.
I'm actually doing a couple other projects, too. You know, I'm starting to venture off into different styles of writing. I'm actually doing a sort of semi-biographical about my hometown of Spanish Fort, Alabama, growing up in that area. I'm doing some other pretty cool stuff, man.
Good. Good. Got to keep busy,
I'm even doing a picture book, believe it or not. I'm doing a comic book and a picture book.
Wow. And the next Stan Lee, right?
Well, I'm doing a comic book with my father called The Adventures of Mufti the Wise.
Okay.
It's about this Pakistani who is just convinced of his own wisdom and is convinced he needs to spread it throughout the world. And he has a partner who was hired by his family to tag along and keep him out of trouble. And, of course, at the end of every episode, Mufti's just fine, and his partner ends up in the hospital. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah, we'll have to wait for Mufti then, right?
I think it's going to be a lot of fun. But it's been great, man. You know, I mean, the Godling Chronicles have really opened up a lot of new worlds for me. So, I mean, being able to do that has expanded what I want to do.
Yeah,
and that's one thing I think writing does for you is expand what you want to do.
It sure does. Absolutely. Look where I am today. I've got people calling me and meeting me and emailing me, and it's a whole different world even within the last 8 months from where it used to be with me. It's a whole new thing that I'm doing now, and I just really love what I'm doing. I'd like to get into my half of the writer's topics today, and with the topic of Hitler coming up soon within the next 5 minutes when Jonathan calls in, I'd like to relate a little bit of a story. But my grandfather, when I was younger, I had gone to school and came home. And, of course, my grandparents adopted me, so they were like my mom and dad. Well, I'd come home from school, and my grandfather would be greeting me there at the door. And he'd say, Tom, what'd you learn today? And I would tell him about the evils of Hitler. And, of course, he would look back at me and say, well, don't judge a book by its cover. Isn't that appropriate for today's show? So he told me before I jumped to any kind of conclusions about anybody that you should listen to their side of the story, and he encouraged me to read Mein Kampf, which, of course, is a book that Adolf wrote, and it was translated to My Struggle. So if Adolf had been a an author on our program here, we would introduce him and we would ask him what the book was about. And so he would tell us. It was a very lengthy book. And with that, I've got a little bit of a sound clip here that kind of talks a little bit about the Jews and the real concern here is that, and most people probably don't know this, maybe some do, people like you yourself, Brian, who studied history, know that the Jews have been prosecuted down through the ages, even before Hitler came to power, and there was a lot of atrocities that were happening even before his reign. Now, he introduced the book.
Well, like we were talking about before the show, you know?
Yep, he introduced the book.
We were talking about before the show. Hitler didn't invent anti-Semitism. He just, you know, played on it.
Right. In 1924, he wrote Mein Kampf, and he took office in 1933. But this clip here explains a little bit about the book and a little bit about the Jews before that time. But let me let you listen to this clip, and then we'll be back to meet Jonathan Maxwell.
In 1924, while Hitler was in prison after his attempt to seize power in Munich had failed, he wrote his autobiography, which he called Mein Kampf, My Struggle. In Mein Kampf, Hitler attacked the Jews. In fact, there are more entries under Jews in the index than anything else except National Socialism. No one need be in doubt about what he said or intended to do about the Jews, as Punch pointed out 3 years ago, when already over 1 million copies had been sold, if not read. He blamed the Jews for Germany's defeat in the Great War, for the revolution which followed, and even for the runaway inflation of 1923, which nearly wrecked the German economy. Of course, blaming the Jews in Europe for any trouble isn't new. In the Middle Ages, Jews often had to wear special badges to show they were Jews. They had to live in ghettos, their own special quarters, in cities, as outcasts from Christian society. When the Black Death struck, it was the Jews who were often blamed for poisoning the Christians' drinking water. In the riots which always followed, mobs looted and burned the Jewish ghettos. They murdered those who would not give up their faith, man, woman, or child. All this happened not only in Germany, but in other countries, such as England, and in Russia, where in the first 10 years of this century, Christians made several murderous attacks on Jews in Russian cities. Christian charity wasn't being shown to the Jews. But in most countries, Jews had equal legal rights by the beginning of this century. In Germany, Jews began to take their place in German society as leading politicians, scientists like Albert Einstein, and artists. Under the Weimar Republic with President Ebert, the Jews were guaranteed equal rights for the first time. But many of the new socialist leaders were Jews, so it was easy to say that anyone who wanted change was a Jew.
Okay, there you go, and now on with the book. I see that Jonathan is waiting patiently on the line here for us to get to him. And the book, Murderous Intellectuals, is written by Jonathan Maxwell and published by American Book Publishing in 2009. You may purchase it at Amazon.com/Kindle. Amazon has this little bit to say about the book, searching for a sense of understanding and a hope for future prevention. Jonathan Maxwell explores the different officials of the Holocaust, giving an extensive background of each. He investigates mental defects, childhood occurrences, and family situations of these horrific leaders and identifies the desk murderers, those who did not directly kill but gave orders to kill. In this concentrated look at the events that took place, Maxwell attempts to identify the key causes of the mass murders in an effort to prevent future Holocaust. And this is what I have to say about it, and it's so hard to imagine the atrocities that people will go to satisfy what they believe to be the will of the whole nation of people, or at least a large segment of a population, who have unwittingly pledged their allegiance to a monster. When doctors would give up their practice and abandon their Hippocratic oath to do no harm and actually kill people that they termed as subhuman, it is beyond reproachable behavior. Included in this group were other madmen and members of society who would murder a whole populace of people, many of whom were considered intellectuals by their peers. In many instances, a 1 degree difference in your skull index size would determine if you were of the master race or subhuman. If you came out on the wrong end of the measurement, you were sent to your death in a gas chamber or other form of eradication to satisfy the German question and Hitler's final solution. Even the common citizens of Germany met a terrible fate if they happened to be disabled. If they were, they were labeled as worthless and were either killed or made sterile to preserve the master race. Babies were taken and thrown into rivers and told to boil there, you offspring of the devil. Jonathan Maxwell presents another interesting look at the Holocaust, where he looks into the mindset of the murderous intellectuals and attempts to make sense of it all by examining the behavioral histories of those involved. In this book, you will learn that Hitler, as a young boy, was an introvert and a poor student, and we were given insight into what may have influenced him to become one of the evilest men in history. The author also gives us pause to consider that we are still living in times of great human suffering at the hands of world leaders, and that history, in the case of the Nazis and the Holocaust, may well someday repeat itself. Brian and I are happy to have with us today on the Writer's Lounge, Jonathan Maxwell. And Jonathan, after I click this button, we are bringing you on the air. And how are you doing, sir?
I'm fine. How are you?
Nice to have you on the program. And where are you calling from?
I'm calling from just outside Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh, okay. Very nice weather down there, I would imagine.
Yes, it's very nice, but the really hot weather is coming on. It'll be in a couple of weeks, and then we'll be getting temperatures in the high 90s. So
wow.
We're going to enjoy the fairly nice weather, you know, while it lasts.
Right.
I'm from Mobile, so originally, so I know exactly what you mean.
Oh, sure. I used to live in Mobile.
Wow.
Yeah, at least you can go to the ocean to cool down a little bit.
Yeah,
we really don't have that option here. Yeah.
No, you don't.
Yeah.
You just go stand at the top of the Peachtree Plaza.
Yeah.
Or get on Stone Mountain and see if you can catch a breeze.
Yeah. Hey, Jonathan, once again, thanks for being on the program. I really enjoyed your book. And could you
read
an excerpt from your book?
Yes, I'll read the first couple of pages from the book. And starting right now. In mid-1941, on the eve of Nazi Germany's invasion of the Soviet Union, SS hangman Reinhard Heydrich, blonde, handsome, and breathtakingly ruthless, began to organize the Einsatzgruppen. The Einsatzgruppen, a collection of Schutzstaffel SS task forces, would follow on the heels of the invading German army. Adolf Hitler, who authorized the creation and implementation of these so-called mop-up groups, stated vaguely that they were to perform special tasks for the preparation of the political administration. Officially, each Einsatzgruppe, there were four of them, labeled A, B, C, and D, was to combat partisan activity. In reality, the function of these groups would serve a far more sinister intention, genocide. Each group would find and round up scores of individuals such as socialists, communists, Democrats, Russian intellectuals, and gypsies whom Nazis, in their feverish paranoia, deemed undesirable. Above all, however, the Einsatzgruppen were to liquidate Jews, who constituted the Nazis' despised archenemy. Virtually all of these individuals on the SS's hit list were to be civilians. Most of them would not even be armed guerrillas. In addition, the SS brats would stipulate secretly that all of these subhumans in the occupied areas were to be given special treatment. It's antiseptic euphemism for murdered. All undesirables were to be snuffed out, including those who were physically and mentally handicapped, old and or infirm, women, and children. It was to be a task as ambitious and complex as it was unspeakable. Like any smooth-running organization, military or corporate, each group would require the talents of many dedicated and resourceful specialists, frontline officers and their charges, headquartered administration officials, transportation managers, office personnel, translators, and so on. Luckily for the Third Reich, Hitler had placed the awesome responsibility of unparalleled mass slaughter upon one of his ablest lieutenants. As the second most powerful official within the SS, only Reichsführer SS Heinrich Himmler exercised more control, Heydrich would consistently demonstrate not only a tremendous capacity for cruelty and terror, but for brilliant efficiency as well. Joining the SS in the early 1930s as a secret agent, Heydrich, under Himmler's obsessive tutelage, would, within a decade, be the head of a host of Nazi offices. These offices included the SD, which oversaw both foreign and domestic intelligence, SIPO, the security police, Kripo, the criminal police, and the Gestapo, the secret state police. His duties included the implementation and high-level management of the dreaded concentration camps, the crushing of political opposition, the suppression of foreign intrigue, and so on. Unfortunately, in the bizarre, nightmarish world of the Nazis, Heydrich performed these tasks well. Under the leadership of Himmler and Heydrich, Germany, the home of Brahms and Martin Luther, became a totalitarian state. Himmler's deputy, although brutal, was far from being a mindless thug. He was intelligent, deeply analytical, and an experienced military man. From 1926 to 1931, Reinhard Heydrich served as a German naval officer. Although he would be dismissed from the Navy because of his compulsive womanizing, he was nevertheless regarded as a confident and disciplined young leader. Drawing upon his military experiences and his gift for meticulous planning, Heydrich quickly developed a vision for effective Einsatzgruppen. According to him, the enterprise would be a lean and nimbly mobile collective entity comprised of about 3,000 men as well as a few women. Of the four task forces, Einsatzgruppe A was to be the largest, with a complement of 1,000 men. The other groups, B, C, and D, would each contain between 600 and 700 soldiers. Most of the rank-and-file members would be selected for their brutality and fanatical mindset. While the number would no doubt include some ordinary police officers, many more would be misfits. Some would be disciplinary cases from the Waffen-SS, the combat fighting wing of the SS. These men could avoid prosecution for infractions by joining a task force. A few would even be local, usually Ukrainian anti-Semites, as well as mentally unstable prisoners whom Nazi officials would conveniently release from jails to carry out their nefarious new duties.
Very good, Jonathan. And I have with me Brian Anderson, who is more of a student of history, especially Nazi Germany history, than I am. But before we get to Brian's question or comments on what you just wrote, what differs from what you wrote to what others wrote about the Holocaust?
Well, I'd like to think that my book is special because it closely analyzes the psychological mindsets of the perpetrators. Most books describe what happened during the Holocaust. My work seeks to explain, you know, why the Holocaust happened. That's the way I like to think about it anyway. Of course, you know, many writers have addressed these the mindsets, but I'd like to think that I explore that more comprehensively.
Very good. Brian?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I've always found interesting about National Socialism, and you look at during that time the rise of the Bolsheviks and, you know, and the communist nations, of the Soviet republics, that you would a lot of people would think on the surface they would be allies as opposed to enemies because they're both socialists, and that a lot of people really don't understand that there are two different types of socialism. There was the class socialism that was applied in the Soviet Union, as opposed to a national socialism that of Nazi Germany, which actually, even though they're both socialist people, a lot of people don't see that it's so both socialist but very opposite at the same time. And the national socialism, it really did enable anti-Semitism to thrive.
Absolutely. You always have to keep in mind that socialism through the decades, has had many meanings. Hitler's definition of socialism was quite different from many other definitions. When he used the word socialism, he was referring to the individual's obligation to the state. That's what he meant by socialism. Yeah, and in fact, the Bolsheviks and the National Socialists absolutely detested one another because, in many ways, their goals were, opposed to one another. The Bolsheviks sought to eliminate social distinctions, whereas Nazism was actually built on social distinctions. In the Nazis' case, on racial and ethnic purity, and so they actually quite detested one another fiercely. In fact, Russia suffered terribly under the heel of the Nazis, perhaps more than any other nation, and a lot of that was driven by ideology.
Well, except for maybe Stalin, who ended up slaughtering 11 million of his own people.
Absolutely. Hitler and Stalin, they did have one thing in common. They did both hate Jews. Yeah. Oh, yeah, aside from that, yeah. But both were terrible, Jew bashers. And it's been estimated that Stalin actually killed just as many Jews as Hitler did.
Yeah, but yeah, we hear about Hitler and more focused on him than anybody else. But Jonathan, during your research, what did you find interesting about Hitler that you weren't aware of before you wrote the book?
One of the things that I found really intriguing was that he had always been surrounded by good, helpful, friendly Jews. When he was a child, the family doctor was Jewish. There were several prominent Jewish families in Austria where he was born and raised. And later on, during World War I, Hitler admittedly was a brave soldier, but the officer who recommended that he receive a major award for his bravery, a medal for his bravery, was Jewish. Later on in Vienna, when he was struggling to become a painter, he sold very few paintings, but the ones who did buy his works of art were Jews. And evidently, he got along with them quite well.
Yeah.
And that I found very ironic, and that seems very, very surprising, but you have to keep in mind that just displays how disturbed Adolf Hitler was.
Yeah,
he was so disturbed that he needed to find scapegoats, and because of that desire to find scapegoats, he was far removed from reality.
Yeah.
Well, that's something that goes on in history, that still goes on in history, has been for the, even since, if you look at even Fidel Castro, when he took over Cuba, Fidel Castro was never really a communist. He was anti-American, and the Soviet Union was willing to support him. He used America and what was going on as a way to get into power. It seems to me like Hitler did something very similar before he did.
Sure.
What I found interesting about Hitler, Jonathan, was aside from what you talked about there regarding his connection with Jews, I found it interesting that he was actually not very well liked as a student, and he was a rather poor student, which kind of amazed me. He must have evolved at some point, and I know you touched on it in your book, but that's what kind of shocked me.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Through most of his life, he was very much a social failure. He received poor marks in school. He even received poor grades in German. He was a failed painter. He tried to get into art school, but he was rejected in Vienna. He hoped to make a living as an artist, but after about 2 years of living in Vienna, you know, he became a homeless person. He had great troubles making friends, and you actually see this quite often in regards to the personal backgrounds of Nazis. A lot of them had been personally maligned in some way. Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's chief propagandist, he was one such individual. He was a very tiny man. He stood only about 5 feet tall. He also had a club foot. He tried to become a soldier during World War I, but the recruiters laughed at him. He had long been the victim of bullying, and there were several other Nazis, well, more than several, many Nazis who had that pattern. You had Hermann Göring. You know, he was actually a World War I flying ace, superbly educated, actually came from, you know, an upper-class background. But he comes home after the war, and, of course, he's very depressed over, you know, Germany's loss. He comes back to Germany, and he can't find work. And again, you see this, you know, again and again, individuals who feel like misfits, people who feel like they're on the margins of society. And it's interesting because serial killers and mass murderers, they tend to have these same, you know, personal backgrounds. During their early years, their formative years, they received a lot of rejection, a lot of neglect, perhaps even some persecution.
I would think, too, that the book Mein Kampf, which actually is translated to My Struggle, is sort of a touch upon of what he was struggling through his whole entire life to get to that point where
sure.
He was taking leadership positions. So I found that also interesting when I saw that he was a poor, unlike student, and then when he wrote Mein Kampf, My Struggle, that it may have had more of a deeper meaning than just a political sense of his hatred of Jews.
Yeah, and a lot of other individuals, you know, felt the same way. They also felt like they were struggling, particularly since the, you know, Germany's loss during World War One, and the economic depression. So, you know, there are good reasons why Mein Kampf really reverberated with the Germans, because as a whole, you know, Germany was struggling. So in some ways, Hitler actually symbolized what was going on in the nation at the time.
Well, people forget that that during the Great Depression, which would have been several years after, but just but during the time when Hitler took power, that the Great Depression, a lot of people, especially here in the United States, view it as the Great Depression of the United States, basically. They don't realize that the Great Depression was worldwide. And
oh, absolutely.
That Germany
sure.
That was not only a war-beaten nation, but also suffering through the Great Depression, and was primed for a guy like Hitler, who showed them hope and promise in their eyes, and a chicken every pot, I think, was one of his campaign promises. Primed for men like that to take over.
Oh, yeah. And a lot of people don't stop to consider that the Nazis were actually democratically elected. You know, it wasn't anything like a coup d'etat. You know, they were elected through legal means. It's just that the Nazis, they claimed to have the answers to everything, and the German people were so depressed, so utterly humiliated, so hopeless that, you know, they chose to believe them. Of course, you know, in the long run, the Nazis made things, you know, much, much worse.
Well,
yeah.
A lot of people, you talk about in your book that, you know, about the pencil pushers, the guys behind the desk who were committing the worst atrocities without pulling triggers.
Sure.
And a lot of people don't understand, you know, I've heard something, I would never do such a thing, and how people could do things like that. And they forget there was a study, I'm sure you're aware of that study done in America with the, you know, with actors behind one screen and just a typical guy off the street in another, shocking,
oh, yeah,
supposedly. Yeah, I forget what the study is called, and it was a study done to see whether or not the average American would shock somebody until they died just because they were told to.
Oh, you sure, know, sure.
Sort of was supporting the, but because it supported the Nuremberg defense, nobody wanted to hear the results of this until much, much later.
Oh, sure.
These were the pencil pushers telling people to do stuff, and like in your book, you're discussing, you know, people who were behind the scenes. And that, and a lot of people don't understand how vulnerable we are even today to succumb to things like that.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the reasons why the you know, the Holocaust was so effective was because, you know, the men who were ordering the murders, the people who were ultimately behind the carnage, you know, they were far removed from the camps and they were far removed from the killing fields. You know, the murders that they saw, the people receiving special treatment, they were more or less numbers. It's very interesting because during the trials, when, you know, witnesses were providing testimony and there were films that were documenting the atrocities, many of the defendants were actually shocked and sickened by what they had done. Of course, you know, while the murders were going on, it didn't really sink in because, you know, they were sitting behind death. It's why they were called, you know, the death murderers.
Yeah, that I found that disturbing. Of course, not surprising that there has to be a network behind the main characters in the book. But as far as the characters, like the doctors who, you know, denounced their Hippocratic Oath to go and start killing and torturing and experimenting on people, I found that amazingly horrible. Of all the characters that you mentioned in your book, Jonathan, who supported Hitler, who is the one who stands out the most as being the closest to standing on moral ground, if there is any moral ground in that atrocity?
I would have to say that would be Heinrich Himmler. He was the top man in the SS, meaning Schutzstaffel, the protection squad. That was the group that spearheaded the Holocaust. Generally, he holds equal responsibility with Hitler because he was the man who ultimately drove the genocide. Adolf Hitler was actually more of an idea man. Heinrich Himmler, being an exceptional bureaucrat, he was the details man. He was the one that organized the camps and as well as coming up with the idea of, you know, human experimentation. You know, he was the bureaucrat who, you know, more or less built the Nazi state. That being said, there were many, many individuals like Heinrich Himmler. There was Goering, there was Albert Speer, there was Adolf Eichmann, and it's very intriguing about these individuals because they didn't act as robots. They were driven, you know, ideologues. They believed in Hitler. They wanted to please him, and they were actually very, very creative in their endeavors. They were always trying to make genocide, you know, more effective, more efficient. Particularly Adolf Eichmann and Rudolf Hirsch, who was one of the commandants of Auschwitz. Early on, carbon dioxide was used to murder Jews in the camps, but there were a lot of technical problems associated with carbon dioxide. So Adolf Eichmann and Rudolf Hirsch, they on their own initiatives, you know, they did research and they found a better poisoning agent, that being, you know, Zyklon B, which was used so extensively in Auschwitz. And Hitler had nothing to do with it. you know, as far as the Holocaust goes, you know, he ordered it, he ordered the Final Solution, and then he left things to his underlings to, you know, to drive it, to manage it, to make it effective. He was surrounded by creative, driven individuals. They didn't act like sheep at all. They weren't merely doing what they were told.
Right. You also touched on some of the possible causes which makes people do what some of these monsters did. Can you explain some of these causes, more of a medical slant to these? Which one do you think contributed the most to the atrocities that happened?
Well, there wasn't just, you know, one tidy factor. Germany's humiliation after World War I was a factor. The Treaty of Versailles, that was a factor. The economic depression was a factor. One factor that I always found fascinating was, you know, in regards to a Freudian theory, the fact that, you know, many of the Nazis, they endured nightmarish childhoods, and that caused them to become monsters, just as nightmarish childhoods, you know, caused individuals like Jeffrey Dahmer to commit murder. It's kind of a problematic theory, though. There were many Nazis who did have very poor childhoods, including Adolf Hitler, who, you know, resided in an abusive household. There were individuals who endured a lot of physical abuse. But then again, you had individuals like Albert Speer and Heinrich Himmler who enjoyed solid middle-class or upper-class backgrounds, very stable home lives, good parents, good education. You know, these were individuals who were expected to be the best and the brightest in society.
Right.
They were quite popular in high school. They went on to college. And in spite of their good breeding, their stable home lives, they still became monsters. So you always have to be mindful of the fact that the Nazis were very, very complex individuals.
Right, Brian?
You mentioned earlier about Zircon B going from carbon monoxide and to Zircon B. And it reminded me, and I was thinking maybe you might know exactly when they started using gas as opposed to, I remember, I think it might have been Himmler, got a letter from one of the commandants saying that they were shooting Jews.
Oh, sure, sure.
It was taking a toll on the soldiers having to do this horrific thing by hand.
Oh, yeah. The Holocaust actually evolved. It started first with boycotts, then it was immigration, then it was deportation to Jewish ghettos, and the Nazis were disappointed with these policies, so, you know, they got more radical. And so by 1939, shortly after the invasion of Poland, they began rounding up Jews and shooting them. Eventually, these task forces would shoot about 1.4 million Jews. There was one atrocity at a Russian ravine called Babi Yar, where over a two-day period, some 35,000 Jews were shot dead. And so it was actually very, very effective. But it was also bloody, brutal business. You know, oftentimes the perpetrators, they would get themselves covered in blood, covered in brain matter, just very gruesome stuff. And the close proximity, particularly when they were trying to shoot women and children, really took a toll on them mentally and emotionally. Many of them developed mental illness. Many became sadists. There were suicides, sometimes even homicides. They would open, you know, some of these soldiers would open fire on their own fellow perpetrators. And so that's one of the big reasons why they began turning to the gas chambers, because in many ways they were quieter, they were more clinical, they were easier to keep secret, they were stationary, they were located in very remote areas, usually often in the wilderness, and they generally, as far as the ones who actually did the killing, oftentimes they would use Ukrainians for that. And sometimes they would even use Jews. They had these squads called Sonderkommandos. These were the individuals that would transport the corpses from the gas chambers to the crematories. And they were generally manned by Jews. And so within the camps, oftentimes the SS members, even though they, you know, worked on site, they were in many ways removed from the actual slaughter. They generally stayed behind their desks.
Yeah, certainly some horrific descriptions there that you give, Jonathan, and I can't help but think that these were human beings. And given that, and one has to sit back and pose this question, is there anything going on in American politics today in our country, or are there any laws in our country that might predispose us of falling into a regime like the Nazis, what the Nazis brought to the German people? Is that possible?
Well, you know, in my view, basically anything is possible. You know, it's funny about Germany, because at the time Hitler came to power, Germany was probably the most advanced, most industrialized nation in the world, and it also had a reputation for being very, very progressive, particularly in regards to Jews. If you were a Jew in Europe during that time period, you wanted to live in Germany because that's where you were treated best. And so, you know, if a Holocaust happened, they are certainly
ideas from us. They took their eugenics ideas from us. We'd not be
able
to
around. Oh, sure, absolutely. Yeah, and America has already had you know, experiences with genocide. Look what we did to the Native Americans. And as far as the African slave trade, you know, it wasn't a genocide in the most literal of senses, but still, it was very much
a cultural genocide.
Yes, kidnapping, deportment, slave labor, atrocities. Yeah, a lot of similarities with what was going on in Germany.
The Germans at that time, during the 1920s and 30s, because we had experiments here in the United States, well, we were sterilizing undesirables, hundreds and hundreds. The Germans took their cues from us. People think that we got that idea from them. No. It was. They looked to us for those ideas.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. And, you know, in many ways, America actually pioneered germ warfare, because whenever we wanted to eliminate an Indian tribe, we would give them blankets that were infected with, you know, smallpox viruses.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, it can happen anywhere. And indeed, even though the public has said, you know, time and time again, never again, meaning that they'll never allow another Holocaust to happen, there have been genocides. There was a genocide in Cambodia.
Colombia, for example.
Yeah, the international population hardly took notice. There was a genocide going on in Rwanda. And this is in, you know, this is current affairs. Oh, sure, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you see a pattern there. People instinctively want to look away, and that's what was going on, you know, during the you know, Hitler's Final Solution. There's no way that you can hide the murders of, you know, 12 million people. The Allies knew what was going on. But you know, people all share these instincts, and one of these instincts is that when you're faced with something horrible, you look away from it, and that was a problem then, and I think it's a problem now. So it's something that we always have to be aware of, and we also have to try to correct those impulses, which isn't easy to do.
Jonathan, to kind of segue into that thought, not looking away from it, I want to propose a question to you that is sort of fictional in theme. You know that we do a lot of fictional books on this program, and
sure. This
is probably one of the most serious programs that we've done. In fact, I would say that it is the most serious program that we've touched upon. But if you had a time machine and you went back in time and you were led to a building where there was a door, and they opened that door and pushed you inside of it and closed and locked that door, and inside that door, seated there at a table, just one person, was you and Adolf Hitler, and you had 5 minutes with him, what would you ask him and what would you say to him?
This sounds barbaric, but I wouldn't try to reason with him, because I don't think you can reason with individuals like that. I would have tried to kill him. I would have gone along and I would have tried to kill him. And sure, that sounds barbaric, but and this is a terrible thing to say, but you know, some individuals should die. The world would have been a whole lot better off without persons like Stalin and Hitler and you know, Mao Zedong.
Okay, so what would you say to him? I'm not really reasoning with him, but what would be the first words out of your mouth?
I suppose why. Why would you want to do such a thing? Particularly women and children. You know, I spent 2.5 years, you know, doing research, and I still can't really answer that question. And in a lot of ways, it's unknowable because it is so senseless.
Right, it is. Jonathan, we've got just a little over 7 minutes left here of the program. It's been a very interesting show so far, and we've got some more time, of course, but I want to kind of skip away a little bit from Murderous Intellectuals, and we understand that you've just recently published another book. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, it's called Piltdown Man and Other Hoaxes. It's about scientific hoaxes through history. I touch upon the missing link hoax, as well as Bigfoot, the Yeti, the Loch Ness Monster, sea serpents. It's a lighthearted, fun book. It's designed for both adult and juvenile readers. I wanted to make a big departure from my first book. I wanted something enjoyable. I was sick and tired of the gloom and doom, so I just went off in a far different direction.
Yeah. We can't wait to have you come on the program with maybe a strictly, totally humorous book at some point, so we can see that side of you in the future. Because I'm sure it's there. Besides writing, what do you do for fun there in Georgia?
Well, I'm in grad school, so I really don't have time for fun.
Okay.
I used to enjoy reading and going to the movies, eating out. But with my studies, I really don't have time to do anything. I sleep and eat and study, and that's basically it.
Okay. Well, we got to get you out of that mode at some point. And, you know, you should tune into our show. On occasion, we have some lighthearted conversations with authors, and they've got some really good books out there. And you're our 22nd author on the Writer's Lounge, and it's been great having you with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Can you tell, before you take off there, can you tell us where we can find you on the Internet?
Readers and listeners are welcome to contact me on Facebook, and they can find my books at Barnes & Noble and on Amazon.com.
Okay. And Brian, what do you got for Jonathan? Some parting words or questions or comments?
You know what? It's been very, very great talking to you. You know, in my household, history,
thank
especially
you.
World War II history, was, you know, a big thing. My father's undergraduate work was in history, so you can imagine that's all we kind of talked about. And
oh,
you
sure.
know, I just wish that more people out there would take a look at it, because there seems to be a waning interest in our own history.
Oh yes, and Holocaust denial is becoming a big problem now. When I was doing my research, one horrifying thing that I found was that while doing my research, I found out that there were just numerous Holocaust denial websites. And a lot of these kids nowadays, it's just natural for them to do their research online. And a lot of the stuff that, you know, they're finding online are just absolute lies. And unfortunately, a lot of these kids don't know any better. And so Holocaust denial, I think that's going to be one of the world's biggest problems, but before long.
Yeah, that's certainly the case, and we hope to God that that never happens again. And
sure.
As we've touched on, it is happening, but we're so caught up in everything else in our lives with the Internet and all this information that's tumbling at us, it's kind of hard to stay focused like they probably did back in World War II times when they had just one story coming at them, and that was the war and those atrocities that were happening too. So once again, Jonathan, thank you for being on the Writer's Lounge. And
it was a pleasure.
I would like to find your book. Can you name it again, the new one that you just put out?
Piltdown Man and Other Hoaxes.
Okay, it's PILTDOWN, right?
Yes, it is, yes.
Okay, and go look for that one, folks. And also, once again, get a copy of Murderous Intellectuals. You can find it in format. And that will pretty much do it for you, Jonathan. And we'll kind of look up that book there, Piltdown Man. And I'm going to enjoy reading that also. And we might even ask you to come on to do a review of that or interview with that.
That sounds wonderful. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Jonathan. Have a good time there in Georgia.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, there, Brian, we've come to another end of the Writer's Lounge, show number 22. And next week we will be meeting with Bonnie Hartle, and she will be on in my beautiful beautiful and talented Robin Eduardo will be with me. And, Brian, not that you're beautiful or you're not beautiful, but you have really added to today's program, and I thank you so much for being on, and good luck with that second book.
Pleasure as always, Tom.
Yep, it's been fun, my friend, and we will talk. And until then, as we always say on the Writer's Lounge, good reading and good writing. We'll see you next week.
In the middle of the day, your faith and your fences have been blown away. You're down in the cellar and you've locked yourself in. Ah, but it looks like it's rainbow weather again. It looks like it's rainbow weather again. Storm clouds apart and the sun will peek in. The rain will roll out wind, and it looks like it's rainbow weather again. One beautiful morn, he said, Noah, get ready, for the sky will be torn. Build as I tell you, save what you can. wait while the rainbow weather begins. It looks like it's rainbow weather again. Storm clouds apart and the sun will peek in. The rain will roll out on a westerly wind. And it looks like it's rainbow weather. Trouble will come, but trouble will go. You're living in fear, but what do you know? You know that the sun's always coming then. You know there'll be rainbow weather again. It looks like it's rainbow weather again. The storm clouds apart and the sun will peek in. The rain will roll out. Like it's rainbow weather. Yeah, it looks like it's rainbow weather again. The storm clouds apart and the sun peeking. The rain will